Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. COVID-19 is still killing thousands of people every day, UN Health Agency Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has said, while once again underlining the hugely uneven and inequitable distribution of vaccines. The World Health Organization Director General told journalists that it was extremely disappointing to see that countries which had vaccinated most of their population with two doses were now looking to obtain a third booster shot. What's needed urgently is much greater vaccine production in numerous hubs around the world, Tedros insisted, praising pharmaceutical firm AstraZeneca for sharing the technology it used to make coronavirus vaccine. Tedros also clarified the UN agency's position on vaccine sharing.
When we say share, it's not like giving it for free. I can bring you a long list of countries who are saying we have money, where can we buy the vaccines? Just give us the vaccines, we can pay for it. Many countries do that because they're sick and tired of all the lockdowns and their population are going through. Majority of countries, a big proportion actually, can pay, but they don't have the vaccine.
The WHO appeal comes as it warned that the Delta variant is now present in 104 countries where it's driving a new spike in cases and deaths. The highly transmissible mutation is expected to soon be the dominant COVID-19 strain circulating worldwide. UN humanitarians appealed on Tuesday for far quicker access to Ethiopia's embattled Tigray region after the first aid trucks in days to reach the local capital, Mekele, encountered multiple checks delaying their arrival. Unobstructed aid deliveries are crucial in the northern Ethiopian region, where the World Food Programme, or WFP, says that 4 million people need emergency assistance after more than 8 months of conflict between regional and central government forces. WFP spokesperson Thompson Fury said that Monday's convoy of 50 trucks delivered 900 tons of food along with other emergency supplies. It was the first humanitarian convoy to reach Tigray since operations resumed in the northwest on the 2nd of July.
It took the convoy 4 days to travel from Senegal to Mekele via Abala, a distance of just 445 kilometers, passing through over 10 checkpoints on the way, where at each At every stop, the humanitarian cargo was rigorously checked. It should not be like that. We need to send in convoys every day from now on, so that we are able to meet demand.
Latest first-hand reports from Tigray on Tuesday also appear to confirm that healthcare provision is damaged beyond repair in many areas. According to the World Health Organization, most health centers are not functioning, and medical equipment and supplies have been either removed or destroyed in almost all facilities in the region. To Afghanistan, where the worsening security situation has forced an estimated 270,000 people from their homes since January. The alert from the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, brings the total internally displaced population to more than 3.5 million. UNHCR said that families were fleeing extortion by non-state armed groups and the dangers posed by improvised explosive devices along major roads. Many also reported a breakdown in welfare support and a loss of income owing to the rising insecurity. To help those with acute needs, UNHCR and partners have provided newly displaced Afghans with emergency shelter, food, health, water, sanitation and cash assistance, although many challenges remain in accessing vulnerable groups. According to the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, the number of civilian casualties there rose by 29% in the first quarter of this year compared to the same period 12 months ago. An increasing proportion of women and children were among those targeted. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
my God, oh my God, oh my God. We've got John Grant on the line live. We've got John Grant live. Are you there, John? Can you hear me? John, are you there? What's going on here? John, are you there? We may have a technical problem. Now, John, you got me?
All right, I got you. Okay.
All right. I was getting a little
I don't know what happened.
The vast army of technical nerds, the studio technician Tristan Cadell, everybody was freaking out because nobody's hair is on fire yet, John.
Oh.
But we lost you, I think, for a minute.
Do we have? Well, you got
are you there?
Again. I'm cool. Yeah,
okay.
I'm cool.
Well, we need it.
I just got back from the big city. I was in the city this morning. And let me tell you, for people out in Kansas, it's quite an experience to drive into a city like Philadelphia to do a couple of things. I was going to go see my friend's photo exhibit at the somewhere over at Penn's Landing, and there was all kinds of construction, so I had to go all around. This finally got in there. Had to pay $18 for parking just to go and find out they knew nothing about his exhibit and it's somewhere else. So $18 for like 20 minutes of parking. This is city life. And then I went across town to, I wanted to get a book at a bookstore downtown. So I parked over there, and I paid $5, and, you know, in one of these machines where you have to put your license plate in, and yada, 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 with a credit card. And then I got my book, came back, and I got a ticket there, although I just paid, you know, and so now I have to go through, and, you know, I have a $40 ticket, although I was legally parked, so I have to explain it to them now and to the parking authority. And so that was all just from one trip to Philadelphia, you know. It was like.
And you didn't go to Kensington Avenue, did you? You didn't go down to the forest of the poor.
I didn't go where?
Kensington. Kensington Street.
Oh, no. No, I was in Center City and in West Philadelphia. Anyway,
is Center
it doesn't matter.
City
just,
a suburb?
No. Center City is the central downtown area of Philadelphia. It's called Center City.
That's where the Liberty Bell is and all that shit?
No, Liberty Bell's Philadelphia was very carefully grid set up by William Penn back in the day between two rivers, between the Delaware River, larger, and the Schuylkill River, which is a smaller river. And so it's all on a grid system, and the entire city, at least the central main part of it, is bisected by Market Street going east and west and Broad Street going north and south. And at the intersection is City Hall. And so City Hall is at the intersection, and, you know, you have between the rivers, you have from 1st Street all the way out to 30th Street. And then you go over the Schuylkill, and you get into West Philadelphia, you get up to 60th, 70th Street. So they're all numbered. And it's very easy to find your way around downtown Philadelphia. Unless there's construction and whatnot, you know. And it costs you a pretty penny to park there, let me tell you.
Kansas City is sort of that way, but, you know, really, those parking charges are outrageous. For instance, I used to when I worked in the heart of the city, Kansas City, Missouri, and I had an office up there. I had an office up on the 14th floor of this fucking I shouldn't be so profane so early in the show. But
yeah, it's a little early for that, Mike. That's what I thought too.
I know, but it was $400 a month. I hated
right.
$400 a month in the old telephone building. That's what they call it locally.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And I had a six. Now listen, this is true, man. It was $60 a month because yeah. there was a sweetheart deal with the people who ran the skyscraper I had the office in, and the
mm-hmm.
parking garage people. Now I could go in there and for an hour, okay, well
right.
under an hour, and get out of there, and I still owed them $5. And I said, but I pay you $60 a month to park here. What about?
You know, this is the city.
Yeah.
This is what I, you know, to your red state people and all your rural areas, this is
right.
what you're missing about city life, you know, where people are piled on top of each other and it's just, you know, a madhouse of humanity. And, of course, parking becomes quite a challenge. And, you know, that's why public transportation is so good for city people because you don't have to. You just
yeah.
don't have to worry about putting
yeah.
your damn car somewhere, you know. But here at the
yeah,
you know,
this
at Penn's Landing, I had to pay $18 for the first 6 hours. And if I was only there for 5 minutes, it was still $18.
Right. They didn't give you a discount. And if you parked on the street outside my office,
yeah.
and there was – I had clients that would come in. I was trying to run a private detective operation out of the 14th floor of the old telephone building. And
oh, sounds like Raymond Chandler here, you know, like a private
dude,
eye.
It was worse. It was definitely more seedy and indiscreet than that. It was worse.
And then the blonde dame came through the door. You know?
The only blonde dames that ever came through my door wanted me to go stick a gun in their soon-to-be ex-husband's face. That's all they wanted
uh-oh,
to do.
Uh-oh.
I never did it. Never had to use a gun. But the funny thing was that my clients, some of them, you know, they would come in, and every
right.
goddamn one of them, because there was parking meters everywhere around the thing, it cost $1 an hour. And they would they would come in and say, can you validate this?
I can't. I don't run the parking authority. Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Here. So I always.
Well, that was the golden age, the good old days for a dollar, as they say
I
now.
Know.
Now it's like $18 and just
that's
for five.
Sick.
Well, it is sick, but I'm telling you, this is urban life.
Yeah.
This is why. You know, everybody out in the red states and all that, you know, we have this battle in America now between urban and rural that's taken a political thing because of the Electoral College and all that kind of red state, you know, two senators from Wyoming and, you know, they have, what, 16 people out there and, you know, and then, you know, a big city like if a city like Washington, D.C. became a state, a city-state like Singapore or something, they'd have two senators. But Washington actually may have more people than Wyoming. But anyway, I think we talked about that last week, so that's a repeat.
Well, we can always talk about that. It's a real mess. You're right. I mean,
right. But you go into the city, and of course, no one knows you. You're anonymous. That means nobody gives a rat's ass about you either. I'm hoping they don't give me any crap for this ticket. You know, I have a $40 ticket when I paid the $5, and I have proof of it. I have a receipt. But
you're going to have to go into court, you know.
No,
you contest
I'm just going to send it in. I refuse to take a day off to go into the city just to, you know, when I have proof that I paid it, I have a receipt, you know, in the machine. I mean, it gives you a receipt.
Well, don't send them the original.
Yeah. No, I won't. Certainly not. No, of course.
Because it'll disappear.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We never got the receipt. What are you talking about?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I just sent in to, well, the parking authority in Philadelphia is notorious. I don't know whether they've cleaned it up. They probably have, because it was so, it's pretty rotten, you know. Everybody's getting their, you know, tickets fixed, unless you're a loser, and then you had to pay your ticket, of course. But nowadays, I don't know, but I just had my inspection sticker in Pennsylvania, which is a racket, another racket. Years and years ago, I wrote an op-ed in the Philadelphia Inquirer when they were taking my op-eds, that because my car had been, this garage had taken it, and he didn't have the ball joints that needed to be replaced, he said, because they were loose or something. And so he kept it for a couple of days. And I said, look, I need my car. And then he made me have to sign this to say you refuse to get inspected. I says, okay, I'll sign it. And then I was delivering auto parts to the gangsters down in South Philadelphia, the Bruno brothers. And I got some guy to put it up on the lift and look at it. And he gave me an inspection sticker. It was totally corrupt. But, you know, they've shown evidence-wise having inspection systems like in Pennsylvania do nothing for traffic safety. What they are is they're the lobbying results of the gas station, you know, the mechanics industry, right? And what they do is they get your car, oh, you need a new windshield wiper, you need this, you need that. Anyway, so I wrote this op-ed because the guy had held me because it needed ball joints, because my car, Chevy Nova, I'd driven on Germantown Avenue with all the cobblestones and trolley tracks, and so my ball joints got loose. And I had a famous column in which I said that the state inspection system had you by the ball joints. And it was good. It was, they ran it that way, and that they had you by the ball joints, because it was true. And I got this letter from the state director of saying that John Grant was a louse and all this, you know, and he had no idea what he was talking about.
Really?
We have a wonderful system. And, well, it's the same system. So I just got it inspected. What they do is they give you, there's a big, like it was due in June, there's a big six on the outside of the car and the sticker, so the police can see it's 6, right? It's 2-6, June. Whereas inside, it's the, all you can see with the sun behind it is the guy's scrawl of what date it is. You can't even read his writing, and it's hard to read, so you tend to forget when it's due. And the way you find out in Pennsylvania is you get a ticket, right? Oh, right, it's due. I have a ticket. And so then in the past, I've sent in, you know, I got my car inspected. I sent the receipt in with all that, and they would then forgive me for the ticket. But they didn't do it this time. They said they had a prima facie case against me, and I was guilty, and I need to pay the $41, which I will do. But anyway, this is like city life. I just wanted to impress upon people out there in the wonderful rural areas that, you know, urban life is
tough.
That's the way it's
tough.
It's, you know, it's harassment. It's constant little harassment.
Now it's harassment.
You
heard it first there, listeners. it's harassment.
I think since it's been proven that there's no safety feature to inspection system, and many states don't have it, it shows no difference. I mean, people want to have their brakes work, right? You know, say their windshield wiper smears a little bit, but yeah, it still works. They may not get it right away, but some garages can really fleece people. They have them by the ball joints, as I said, and because you know you're supposed to, if you refuse the garage guy what he says your car needs, and you have to pay him for it. No, it doesn't need that. My car is fine. Well, you have to sign this saying you refused, and it goes to the state.
John, it's just, it's legal, and it's corruption. It's corrupting. I understand that, but
it's a kind of a mild corruption. And it's just city life, you know.
Right. You made the mistake of going in there without a fat load of money. You shouldn't do that, John.
Well, no, I had a credit card, so the credit card took care of everything.
Well, that's a load of money nowadays. I mean, that's just a load of money. But the fact of the matter is that despite your creaking ball joints and all these problems, you have not entertained the same tenacity you exhibit in your article about to be released on Discomfort Magazine, listeners, the hard copy, retro punk fanzine copy of Discomfort Magazine is about to come out.
Okay.
And you've not demonstrated the tenacity. I mean,
do you have a mine in there? Well, I forget. What is it?
I always enjoy surprising the writers, listeners, the contributing writers, the featured contributing writers. I have a John Grant in the dark. I like that. I have Lynn Washington in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some other really probably people mm-hmm. who might sue me. They might sue me.
Okay.
I've reprinted.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up in Discomfort Magazine, it is a dynamite issue. I'm finishing up the last couple pages.
Can't wait to see it. Absolutely.
Oh my God.
Do you have the
God,
next installment just on the trouser or whatever it is?
No, but I got a guy. Last night he texted me. Oh, by the way, we got a caller. And I think the caller is Carl from last week. I think Carl from Kansas City is. And Carl, if you're listening, I'll put you on in just a minute. But this latest issue of Discomfort Magazine is, of course, I'm opinionated. It is a real work of art. And John, you're in it. Lynn Washington's in it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this can't be happening. This can't be happening. It is the flagship of featured contributing writers. And I always love featuring TCBH, This Can't Be Happening, thiscan'tbehappening.net, writers, because it's just like great stuff. Now, I'm not going to give away what I'm reprinting to you, John, because you might say, well, we didn't talk about that. You know, that's okay. You know, that's all right. But Lynn Washington's piece is absolutely hilarious and funny and sick. As is the times we are living in, it's funny and sick. And I think it's going to be one of the best issues we've done. I've started looking at each issue of Discomfort as if I'm mm-hmm. designing a record album, an old vinyl record album cover, like from the Doors or Iron Butterflies. Like every issue has a theme, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, mm-hmm. I only produce it as I feel it coming, you know.
Boom, well, good. Boom, 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 you spend boom, a lot of time with it. You can see that. And all the, I don't know where you get your imagery, but all those, some of them are like 19th century kind of imagery. It's really wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Very retro in some respects. But
that's what I was going to tell you. This one reader who has my phone number, which I don't like, he texts me and he says, when is the next issue coming out? And I says, I'm finishing it up right now. And he goes, well, can you send me an electronic copy? And I go, no, absolutely no way. I sent him, I made a mistake of sending him a retro internet copy. And it wasn't even done last issue 3 months ago. And, you know, it's like, you know, he just wanted in on the secret, you know.
Right. Well, you know, beauty of it is that it's it has a retro quality, and it's hard to be retro.
He didn't
when
get
you're
mad
talking
at me
about digital. Yeah.
He did not get mad at me. To his credit, and he's a long time friend. He did not get mad at me.
okay? But he sent the word over my fucking phone that said retro. I dig
it. Ooh, there you go.
I go, okay, so I haven't even bothered to return a phone call. I think we have Carl. Carl, I hope Carl's there. I'm going to put him on live. He doesn't punch.
Hello?
He doesn't punch one, so I don't know when he wants to. We'll see if he's even there. Carl, are you there?
Hey, greetings from Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley.
All right. Well, how you doing, Carl?
Y'all had me at ball joints.
Yeah. Well, they put that in the Philadelphia Inquirer that they had you by the ball joints because they couldn't argue with it. He had me by the ball joints because he wouldn't let my car go unless he replaced the ball joints. Anyway, that's Philadelphia life.
Well, see, I had a, you know, Kansas City has more interstate highway than any city in the U.S., so there's plenty of potholes to go around.
Oh, yeah, that'll do your ball joints in, right? Yeah.
You know, and I'd been gone quite a few years, you know, so I was getting acclimated, you know, to the what is described in Philadelphia as a city of country people.
Right, okay.
So,
oh, you rubes out there, huh? Okay.
Yeah, I'm one of them.
I've actually heard city council managers call us the plebes. Oh, we can't go to the opera and sit in the plebe section.
All right. Yeah. Exactly.
But no. So I get back to Kansas City. You know, I'm up on the north side, which you're talking about a city of country people. That's the north side of Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
Carl, you're gonna have to explain to the listeners. We have them all the way to South Africa. North side is north of the river, listeners, and it's really sort of a separate world, largely white now. Maybe that's changed, Carl. Describe Northland.
It's had the largest growth of population in the city. Now, there was a migration at the time when the mafia were fighting at City Market, and you might remember that when the business were getting bombed, you know, and this was still fallout from the Arab oil embargo period.
You have a mafia in Kansas City?
Well,
oh yeah.
It's Chicago mob. We had a guy named Tom Pendergast.
Uh-huh.
And so he dumped so much concrete in the ground, and they were actually digging up chunks of concrete that looked like caskets last week.
Yeah.
You know, and so they were sitting like the ones that look like caskets on one side of the lot, and then they were just crushing up the others, you know, the sidewalks and foundation kind of stuff, you know. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just didn't have time. I wanted to follow that truck and see what they were going to do with these, like, body-sized chunks of concrete.
Well, I remember a famous noir film from the 50s called Kansas City Confidential, which I guess was referring to, the underground sort of underworld of Kansas City, I suppose Missouri, I don't know. But in Kansas City, Kansas, that separated by river from Kansas City, Missouri, is that correct?
Wyandotte County, and this is where the Wyandotte Indians were removed from the Northeast.
Okay.
So that north side and also the Underground Railroad ran there in 1815.
Okay. So the north side refers to the north side of Kansas City, Kansas.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, as well. Now, at one time I delivered pizza on the north side of Kansas City. And I think I delivered in three counties and two states.
Okay, all right.
If that helps. Now, so I'm delivering a pizza one night up there by the Argosy Casino. So that's probably where North Kansas City, Kansas is basically the GM plant, the Ford plant. there's a lot of the grain haulers come out there. Yeah, if you want to get your ass whipped, we invite you to Northside, Kansas City, when those grain haulers are running. There are some scrapping farm boys. Anyway,
scrapping farm. All right.
I went into the Denny's up there on Armour on the north side, like 15 minutes after Ron Paul lost the Republican convention back in, when was that, 08 or? Occupy. There's a primary or something. So anyway, man, these corn-fed truckers came in, and one of them just sits down and just starts glaring at me. I mean, my stomach's hurting. I mean, it's like an eighth-grade ass-whipping going on here.
Eighth-grade ass-whipping. I've been there, man. Oh, wow. I know, down at Redland Junior High, eighth-grade ass-whippings. I remember those.
Yeah, I mean, everything I learned in life, I learned in eighth grade gym class.
Right.
And it came in handy this night at Denny's. You know, so I'm like, what is, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, some places you can go in off the road, and there's certain places, you know, like the bench seats with the cushions are for over-the-road truckers. And then
right.
The hard seat.
Where there are hemorrhoids there, right, yeah.
Yeah, for what you're referring to Philadelphia as the plebes.
Right. You know, I remember going into a little diner, and what was it, in Arkansas. I was in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, and I went over the border to Arkansas for breakfast, and there was this, and they had a distinct line, and it said farmers and truckers. So they had segregated, I don't know why they had fights or something, but the farmer sat on one side and the trucker sat on the other side. But I don't know, it just reminded me of that.
Well, and that exists, that's still, it's basically just so ingrained to us, they don't even have to put up a sign.
Right,
yeah,
everybody
no.
just knows, right.
Yeah, and so anyway, so I'm sitting down, it's like, you know, I'm just going to grab my eat. It was, you know, it's just, 10 hours in Occupy camp, and you know, my job in Occupy camp was basically looking for dirty needles. You know, people say, "Oh, how was it? Was there this unity and holding hands and kumbaya and singing the old, you know, wobbly songs?" No, it was really it was wild. I mean, because Occupy did go where the people most affected by freaking every agency the state has ever built, you know, and that's why they're, you know, that's why they're all camping at that park. But the history of Memorial Park is also the history of Tom Pendergast, because they built a World War I memorial knowing that it would cost $3 million a year to maintain. Now, my attitude about the World War I, World War II memorial is let the damn thing fall in. You know, let's just put a geodesic dome over that, you know, over that part of the city. You know,
because
right next door we got Crown Center that fell in and killed hundreds of people. I mean, that's kind of what, you know, other than maybe John Dillinger and some of those guys coming through 80 years ago, pretty insignificant as historically, other than the corruption.
Right. Well,
so we're finding all this. So we can't get new water lines and sewer lines run through the city because of all this concrete that Tom Pendergast dumped in the ground.
Wow. Wow, what a legacy. Tom Pendergast. Wow.
Well,
Mike, yeah, well, go ahead.
I want to add one thing real quick.
Sure.
Because it's always interesting to hear you and Carl interact. Tom Pendergast, yes, had a big interest in organized crime with the concrete companies. But what's more interesting, Tom Pendergast was the main man that sent Harry Truman, the genocidal maniac with the atomic bombs, to Washington D.C. He was the money man for Harry Truman. Huh. Am I right?
Harry Truman, the man responsible for the Vietnam War, in my view. Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, wow. That's a new
I'm
one.
I'm not a Harry Truman fan. People, you know,
Joe Scarborough
just wrote a book on Harry Truman, one of these glorying books. But, no, Harry Truman, he went with the French who wanted to recolonize Vietnam. And 1945, he did it. He did it entirely. You know, if FDR had been around, he might have done something different. But this cold warrior from Missouri, he decided to go with the French to recolonize Vietnam, and the rest is history. All because of Harry. So he was...
And concrete,
thanks to Pendergrass. Thank you, Mr. Pendergrass, for giving us Harry Truman.
Well,
you know,
talk about
corruption. I was going to raise in Philadelphia here. We just have the big storm now is some guy, he's running for governor. He's a state senator, Doug Mastriano. And he wants to have one of these audits that, like copying the one in Arizona, that we're going to get all the votes and we're going to audit all the votes from the state of Pennsylvania. And it's a big storm here whether he's going to be able to pull this off. And it's so, you know, self-evident that it's all bullshit, that it's based on the big lie, as they're calling it. You know, and the big lie, of course, comes from, what's his name, Goebbels.
The orangutan.
No, not the orangutan, but, you know, the idea of the big lie, which, of course, the Trumpians are exploiting, comes from Joseph Goebbels, you know, the club-footed propaganda minister for Adolf Hitler. He developed the idea and spoke about the idea that, you know, you can get away with a big lie rather than a little lie. And, of course, the reason for that is that it's all about power. It's not about anything else. It's not about reality. It's not about honesty or truth or anything like that. It's simply about power. And if, you know, you have the power and you have enough people that don't care about the truth and the power is all that's important, so, you know, you have a problem. And so this is why we have this problem. And, you know, this guy who's running for governor, wants to run for governor, he thinks this is going to help him run for governor. Whereas we have an attorney general now, Josh Shapiro, who's very tough. And is probably going to cut him short, but we, you know, it's a big question here whether he can pull this audit off, because you know it's a pretty nasty business. I don't know.
Well,
what do you guys...
I mean, the reason I think I have a theory that can't. The reason we don't have that in Kansas is because we're so far in the Stone Age. Conservatives,
right,
including the Democrats, that it's not going to happen yet.
Your state went for Trump, so why would they want to have an audit?
Right. Well, they're even trying to keep they made it a felony where if you even look like an election worker going door to door to register voters, they are, you know, it's a felony. It's a felony, man.
Yeah.
And the groups like these are not socialists, okay? The League of Women Voters, Loud Light, big shout out to Loud Light, and these other groups that register voters to go out they're scared to do it. They've shut down. On July 4th, they said, we're not going to do it because they could get felonies. If some idiot, you know, conservative says, they represent an election worker, arrest them, you know what I mean? just going door to door to register voters. That's the clampdown coming here in Kansas. I don't know about
right,
Carl.
And it's because it's all about power, and by power I mean it's what you can get away with. In other words, if you can arrest somebody, and then you have to go through the courts and get exonerated and all this. I mean, that has an intimidating effect, you know.
My first response was, well, let's make buttons that says, my name is your legal name, and I am not an election worker. You know, it's like, there it is on my chest.
Right.
But then again, elections, what are they worth? I mean, I didn't, like I said on record, I did not vote for anybody till after Ronald. I never was a member of any party or voted for anybody. I never voted until after Ronald Reagan got elected. Then I suddenly just got an interest in what the fuck bourgeois politics are about. And by the way, I got to throw this in, listeners. The switchboard, we could take up to 50 people on the switchboard. 50, the big 50. But, you know, if you want to get in, you need to punch 1 so that you can get online. And I'll be very short.
Well, maybe we should talk about electoral politics, like Carl. Carl, are you still there? Do you vote?
Yes, I do. But, yeah, I consider myself a bystander. To me, it's kind of like my Major League Baseball where,
right.
You know, I start paying attention during the playoffs.
Right, exactly. I know what you mean. Yeah.
And then,
well,
you know,
your vote basically, you know, one person's vote is virtually insignificant. But if everybody said that, you know, then it would add up and it would matter. So, you know, you take 20 minutes or a half an hour. If the Republicans have your way, you take 8 hours to vote, whatever it takes, you know. But, you know, you do it, you know, and you hold your nose if you have to, is the way I look at it. But,
what do you think about just like voting all the judges out, just vote against every judge on the ballot? And that's like the main thing to do is, you know, unless you find someone that actually got somebody out of jail or, you know, off death row or something. You know, what are they?
Yeah, but how can you vote a judge out if you don't vote for him and he just has fewer votes? I mean, this is an up or down sort of question, yes or no on a judge, and that's sort of vote?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, just vote. You know, right. Well, I mean, you know, that's rather an anarchic kind of view, I guess. Is that fair to say? I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I think getting behind Bernie in the primary was very, very much an anarchic move because we're not asking people to go knock on doors, you know, or work the phones necessarily, you know. It's just, you know, repost a Twitter, you know. You know, maybe buy a pizza to the ones that want to go down. But they were fun. The Bernie people were fun to hang out with because, you know, they were young, they were energetic.
Exactly. They're my kind of people, absolutely. And I'm still convinced that Bernie could have won 2016, you know, if the Democrats had not, you know, played dirty with all that kind of Hillary stuff. And, you know, and they'd actually run him as a serious primary candidate. And if he'd won... as a populist, you know, we would have had a left-wing populist and a right-wing populist. It would have been a populist election. And I think a lot of working people, working-class people, would have gravitated to Bernie, and that Bernie could have pulled it off. We'll never know. But, you know, it's an interesting speculation. This idea that discomfited American electorate, working class American electorate, you know, they can go right or left. Eric Hoffer, the stevedore philosopher in the 50s, wrote a book called True Believer. And I remember it. I read it as a kid. And one thing I remember is he said that, you know, right extremes, left extremes, that people can flip. And I think that certainly applies to, you know, the grievances of working class people, especially working class males, white males, that they didn't necessarily have to go to Donald Trump, that they, if they felt that a populist on the left really spoke for them, their needs and all that, that it would have been very different. But again, we will never know the answer to that. It's a speculation.
Well, I mean, I can speculate because I talk to farmers here in the Midwest as much as I
mm-hmm.
can,
mm-hmm.
and their interest is like water rights and livelihood.
Sure.
And preserving that, and how, you know, even the competition between Iowa and Missouri. And competition
mm-hmm.
between the farmers in Minnesota,
right?
And, you know, in this area, it's you know, where there's plenty of water. The further north northeast you go from
right.
here, the Great Lakes, there's plenty of water. Where here,
right.
you know,
exactly, that makes sense. Yeah.
And yeah. and so yeah, I don't see the farmers that far from say the anarchist labor position.
Right. Right.
Because The anarchists are not interested in seizing their land and driving them off the property.
Right.
And, you know, they want to provide the best product available to the market without all the corruption that you've been talking about with your ball joint. I mean, the farmers are going, you know, subsidies. You know, what is a bushel of wheat is what going for what it was during Harry Truman's time?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so you had a truck that cost $2,000 in 1950, and
right.
now that truck is $30,000 or $40,000.
Exactly.
And farmers getting, you know, getting the same price. So, so I think just some, and what I discovered talking with farmers is, you know, their position, the farmer, American farmers' position was set prior to World War I. Because they saw.
Of course, yeah, right. Well, yeah, yeah. Well, the idea of a farm, a small farm. I mean, what happened eventually was, of course, factory farming and huge, huge combines, and you know, killing the family farmer and that sort of thing. But you know, the family farmers who do hold out, small farmers, yeah, have. Probably a lot more in common with people before World War I than they do, you know, like people in the city and things like that. You know. Although I'm sure they use computerization and things like, you know, the modern technologies.
But you know, I mean, if you look about, you know, if you look at the French and English empires, those were made
okay.
with wagons and
yeah.
telegraph. I mean, if you look at the expansion. That you know, prior to 1850 or
mm-hmm.
1970, I mean, computers have done very little for us in comparison to what they did with the slide rule. You
right,
know,
that's interesting. Yeah, I think we are dazzled by our iPhones and all that, but and so it is a good question. What have they actually done for us as human beings? Yeah, you're. You know, they've certainly occupied our minds and our attentions and our entertainment. They have certainly indulged us. We can indulge ourselves in this and that. But, you know, these are all good questions. I think what fucking good is it really to have an iPhone?
But, yeah.
Spoken
yeah,
by someone who still has a flip phone. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you still have to have a pencil sharpener.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. There you go. Right on, Carl. I like that.
You know, I haven't seen it. Have not seen an app for a pencil sharpener yet.
Right.
So, Yeah, so yeah, it's I mean, and you know, and I try, you know, I didn't grow up with games, although I was in Baltimore and I was playing Centipede. I don't know if that was one of the first arcade games, and I'm just killing it. And these kids are standing around me like I'm Roger Daltrey and Tommy, you know, like I got some kind of otherworld intelligence.
Now, I'm sorry, you said this was a pinball machine?
Well, it was the first arcade game. It was like the Atari. Okay. And, you know, they called Clinton's generation the Atari generation.
Right, of course. I remember Atari.
Yeah, so this, you know, this is just a half analog machine. I mean, it had maybe four colors, you know.
But you were good on it. You were good on it. You said you were good on it.
Yeah, because you had to take out the barricades, and then you gotta stop the centipedes from growing.
Right.
You know, and if you, so then finally the last one, you got a couple that fall around, come down to the sides, and so you're basically just doing the same thing. You're moving the joystick left to right, and then you're tapping, firing bullets. That's all it is. But there's a certain motion, you know, there's a little subtle, you know, the timing, because you don't want to go too fast, you don't want to go too slow. But anyway.
Excuse me, Carl, it sounds like sex.
like that?
But
I got to give you
something, Carl. My first game, and I'll be very quick and get it back because we only have about 7 minutes left. My first real, I got really junky. I turned junky on Missile Command, and I would go up to 7-Eleven on Rainbow, just off Rainbow and 39th in Kansas City, me and my buddy, with a roll of quarters, and we would go up there and play Missile Command. And it was the same kind of goddamn madness, and I got to thinking, well, wait a minute, we're blowing up whole cities. Is this the future? And that was.
Well, hey,
years.
Think about drone warfare. You know, that was your like.
Well,
you
wait,
would have made
wait,
a
it's worth
good
that.
Drone warfare
this
candidate
20,
there.
This,
drone
this
warrior.
This is 20 years. This is 20 years before.
Right.
Where we turned Iraq, where we turned Iraq into a. And the Middle East into a pile of rubble. And I was
right.
thinking, God,
and it's
this
training,
is...
It's training like that, you know, updated, of course, that, you know, got people to become drone warriors. You know, you would sit there with your air conditioning, with your Diet Pepsi, and, you know, vaporize somebody 12,000 miles away, you know. And it's
yeah,
not
I mean,
game.
And it's serious.
Yeah.
It is
yeah.
serious. Now,
is, yeah.
can we, in the last... In, 6 minutes, have you heard the latest conservative conspiracy that's about to happen to the world right now?
No, what is it?
Carl?
Help me out here. Yeah.
Well, I got an email today, and it's a solar storm likely to hit Earth today, and the GPS and the internet satellites are all going to be affected. That is at Technology News. I'm going to cite the source because I still try to be a journalist.
Right.
July 12th at firstpost.com.
And what is it again? The solar what?
A solar storm is likely to hit Earth today. It's rated at X1, and X1 is a
wow.
This comes from the Indian Express newspaper. And outlook, and they say that this is it will last for about an hour, and it's X1 level, and that's one of the not the highest by any means. It's considered
so
small.
It's like a
but
it's like a
is,
sun the sunspot or a sunstorm sunspot that's
yeah,
going to affect
a,
what
solar,
it affects our weather or our
well it'll probably affect the UFO
Wi-Fi
too,
or what
I mean.
Does it affect yeah.
It will probably affect even the UFOs on conspiracy radio late at night. I mean, I'm telling you, there's this Armageddon type of thing with the conservatives, with the orangutan and so many others. I think we're on the edge of a zombie apocalypse.
All right, there you go. I think you're probably right. Yeah.
I really do. I think we're on the edge.
We're coming unhinged from truth, the fake news and all that. You know, you can't believe anything anymore because the more distrust that is encouraged and all this big lie stuff, certainly distrust, creates mistrust everywhere in the society. So, the bullshit is taking over. You know, Harry Frankfurt, my favorite writer, philosopher from Harvard, who wrote the book on bullshit, in which he said the most salient feature of American culture is there's so much bullshit. So, you know, we've arrived. It's a giant world of bullshit we're living in. And, the high-toned idea of bullshit, not the normal obscene sense. It's really serious. That why not? I mean, if you have to, instill a state of mistrust and fear in people in order to win them over for an authoritarian ruler like, as you say, the orange orangutan, which would be our version of Vladimir Putin or Viktor Orban in Hungary or that sort of thing. You have to scare the hell out of the people. You have to make sure that they, that democracy is no longer something they can trust. And, with all this stuff going on, and here in Pennsylvania, the guy's going to have a big audit after we've had 16 audits already showing that the election was reasonably good. People don't trust it anymore. And so you're scaring them. You're scaring people. Every night, Sean Hannity talks about, Biden can't string three words together, that he's like a demented old man. And so people are, oh, whoa, that's terrible. We need a really tough guy up there, All of this stuff, it's all going to add up. And, the magic may be over.
Well,
the experiment may be over, and all that.
Right. So.
Well, or as Ben Franklin said, if the people are corrupt, the republic will not hold.
Absolutely. As the guy who used to have 13-year-old girlfriends in France, he knew, man. Yeah.
Oh, he'd make Tom Sawyer blush.
Ben Franklin, Uncle Ben.
Yeah.
But
so,
he was a smart sucker,
Did you hear that Abraham Lincoln used to write Karl Marx when Marx was a society reporter for London,
and so
it was syndicated in New York City. So there's conversations that we're having real time in 1850.
So. Marx was writing for newspapers as a journalist in 1850.
Correct.
Another
famous person who started as a journalist was Benito Mussolini. He was a socialist journalist. He was good, these people, and then they get famous and get deeper and deeper, and there you go.
There was some political commentator after John Kerry lost said the right took over the government, the left took over the English department.
I think we're getting overwhelmed with music here. I think they're telling us something.